at GBQ, we're always counting. Now we're making your time count with this episode of Empower Hour. Start the clock. Today, I'm with Derek Harp, cybersecurity serial entrepreneur, speaker, board member, investor, author, podcast host, and adventurer. But that's not all. I might add that he's a fellow Miami Redhawk alum and a friend. For Derek, I should say, for love and honor, welcome. But those that aren't Miamians wouldn't understand. So we'll just start with welcome, Derek.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'd forgotten that we have that in common, too. I forgot.
Yeah,
we talked about it.
It's weird to know somebody for 20 some years and then, you know, just along the way, find out different things that the Miami thing and the Boy Scout thing, which we might get to
because
we're going to talk about adventures. And then the key things, this cybersecurity thing, because I know and you know and others in at least the cybersecurity world know, most of your time's been spent in that space and that addiction to build and grow businesses one after the other has really been focused on cybersecurity.
It has. Yep.
So we're going to dive into that, but we're going to have to constrain ourselves. And this is supposedly a business podcast, not a geeky cybersecurity podcast. But we will at the end close with that because I think there's a message we both want to deliver to business people about some of the concerns that we have with industrial control systems and them being exposed. But your first business that was here, you built a product that Cisco ended up buying called IntelliShield. That was back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Chiquetis, my firm, started in 2001. So about same time frame, we were trying to protect people that didn't believe that this stuff was going to ever be beyond, you know, script kiddies and guys on skateboards and fun and games. And now it's serious. So how did that business start? But how did that come to be a thing for you, that first business started?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'll have to keep this short because, you know, we've got so many things, like you've already said, things we could unpack today. And it would be fun to unpack. So that one, you know, that episode is, you know, I was in the Navy out of school after leaving Miami. I was in the ROTC there. And I was wanting to be an entrepreneur. That's a theme that goes way back. That's a whole other sort of early formative year story. And so I was writing business plans and thinking about stuff. And so I connected up with another fellow Miami alum who had gone into the Navy a year ahead of me. Come up to DC. You know, you want to start a business? We should go into cybersecurity. And my only experience at that point was working with people with cryptography on the ship. I wasn't a security expert. I wasn't a cryptography expert. I was the manager of the CMS custodian, as they called it. So I was working with really sharp individuals who were concerned with how all this stuff worked. And so sort of managing them was a theme, and that still has played out. I'm not as technical as the people I'm always around. And so we started sort of writing a business plan for Logikeep in 1997. And I still had a little time before I got out, and we pulled in other collaborators that were in the military at the time. And we started off, you know, long story, we started popping out at different times, and, you know, and I pop out, really find that I'm out a little bit ahead of everybody else. And there's been some changes of who's going to be on board. And I went through a short period of like, what the heck do I do? And then I said, you know, it's just, this does look like a big industry, information security. And it was in 97, it was a $1 billion annual industry for the first time. You know, Gartner or Yankee or somebody was writing a report at the time saying, we're spending $1 billion on information security at the same, you know, at this time. And so that's it. We started a company in that space. It pivoted, adjusted things, but it became an IntelliShield product. And it did end up at Cisco, you know, many years later. And I think it has only recently been sunsetted or is being sunsetted. I mean, really in the last year or two. So I had a long, long story. And when I toured it a few years ago, one of our former employees was still running it for Cisco. And there were three or four people there, you know, from our original company in the early 2000s still there. So great experience, learned a ton. We sold it first in 2001. The product went to Cisco in, I think, 2006.
So I only really wanted to start there because it kind of sets our roots in cybersecurity at about the same time. But it's funny because you used information security and we, Chiquetis was an information risk management company. And somewhere along the lines, the marketers have gotten a hold of this stuff and called it cybersecurity, which makes it cooler and sexier. And
way cooler.
Yeah. And it's still the same thing as I've got important information or systems that need to be protected. Data needs to be confidential, that needs to have integrity, and it needs to be available to work. And we're really basically in the game of making sure that within the businesses we work, that confidentiality, integrity, availability is available, or it's available to the business as a characteristic of the information. So you've had this arc that started there in that beginning of the industry, and you've been here along the way. What changes have you seen?
Yeah, well, some things change a lot, some things don't change at all, right? I mean, it depends on what we're going to focus on. You know, it's funny though, when you were talking about that, I would rather work in cyberspace than information space. So those marketers, I thank them for making.
That's true. It sounds, I might want to be an information warrior or a cyber warrior.
I mean, there are lots of things like that. Yeah. It's definitely sexier. I can address that. I think that question in so many different ways. One thing that always comes up, and you know, I professionally speak on this topic, and I love talking to business owner groups. That's my favorite sort of demographic. Small to medium-sized market businesses are, you know, ideally because their maturity, no offense, on security is pretty low, and they can't afford to stay there anymore. And so people talk about, you know, is this space, why are we spending more and more? $1 billion in 1997, whatever it is now, $150 billion or maybe over $200 billion a year now. How are we not arriving? Well, the thing that certainly has not stayed still is that the problem space is getting, you know, much, much bigger. We would say attack surfaces, right?
Yes.
The wave in, the things that are connected. Well, we're still connecting more things per day than that weren't connected yesterday. So we're not trying to solve a known problem, like getting to the moon, the moonshot, you know, a fixed problem, very complicated, but it didn't keep changing on how to do it, you know, or what you were going to try to do. Here, we're trying to do something, but the thing we're trying to solve is actually changing, you know, incredibly rapidly. So I think all these years later, we haven't arrived. We're not going to arrive at security or being secure. We'll maybe arrive at security maturity, that there's processes and procedures that everybody does, you know. And so that's my thing. I think you would have asked me, the younger self, you know, can we get good at this? I'm like, yeah, if we take this step and this step and this step, you know, we can all arrive somewhere. And now I just don't think it is a destination, but just an ongoing process.
I spoke this week, and one of the changes that came up in that presentation was that, and this would have been the time we were both starting those first firms, that we were basically protecting assets, cyber assets, we'll call them that, instead of information assets, but those cyber assets that were in place. It was a server in the server room. It was workstations or tower desktops. Not a lot of laptops at the time, a lot of mainframes where the fence around the building was the perimeter, not the firewall. And now, not only have technology evolved, there's a little bit of technology seemingly in everything. Sometimes it's moving. And so, you know, it's in the car, it's in the delivery truck, it's the robotic drone that's delivering something. So that yes, the attack surface for the non-technical, it's simple. I can hit something that's bigger, easier than something smaller. And a lot of what Derek and I do is to help people identify what that true attack surface is and make it smaller. But that attack surface for us is a lot larger and a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
So I think then through your next to last startup, Next Defense, which was focused on protecting industrial control systems, you learned a lesson that a lot of us are learning, which is IT, information technology, the computer that I'm recording over, the cell phone, and the kind of normal consumer technology is very different from what industry calls operational technology. And you learned that at Next Defense, and then I think stepped out and began the thing that we're going to spend most of our time talking about, which is your latest venture, Control Systems Cybersecurity Association International, which we lovingly refer to as CISA, because sometimes we have trouble with that long phrase. What led you to start a nonprofit? Here, this guy that started these profit organizations, starting with what built IntelliShield, closing with what was Next Defense and some others in between. Why a nonprofit?
Yeah, not by design. It's a great question, because all those other things had deliberate business plans. And there were some other businesses, you know, in between LogicKeep and Next Defense. You picked my two bookends, you know, and those are all, they've all been ventures. Big ambitions, big dreams, you know, business plans and, you know, trajectories. Here's what we're going to do and all these sorts of things. As deliberate as you can be at the beginning of those. This didn't start that way. This was a thing on the side that just grew and grew and grew and grew and grew, and it's sort of taken over. And it's what I'm spending most of my time on today, as are now four of us, with need for more people to be, you know, to be involved, to handle everything that's going on. So I think the truth is that in around 2012, that co-founder of LogicKeep, the late Mike Asante, who went to Miami a year ahead of me, he brought me into the control system or operating technology side of things. All those earlier years had all been traditional, you know, IT cybersecurity. And so I think somewhere around 2011 or whatever, we were skiing. He had stayed in the space. He'd gone deeper into control systems. And we were skiing out near his house and, you know, on a kind of annual get together. And he said, you know, this is this is the next big area of problem. He was looking ahead. And so, you know, Next Defense was born out of sort of that. And then I started a meeting simultaneously with having, you know, having a startup in the space. I started a meeting in Atlanta of people who cared about this problem, right? Operating technology or control systems. Come one, come all in Atlanta, Georgia, where I live. Let's get together once a month and talk about the problem. And that went really, really well. 30, 40, 50 people joined right away, you know, then more people. And we had meetings with 60, 70 people came. And it spawned to Washington, D.C. and Houston, like, do the same thing in this city. You know, there's usually peers in those cities like, hey, this thing you're doing in Atlanta, which I was talking about, it's great. We get together once a month. We talk about the problem. People from OEMs, people from transportation, people from manufacturing, you know, we're all there together, Georgia Tech. And so it just multiplied to other cities. And so it was only later that was like, oh, we should have probably formed an entity of some sort. We might want to be able to receive some funding. We have to be some sort of entity because we have financial needs to continue to support all this desire. And today it's 21,000 people, 110 cities. There's activity in 110 cities. And so, yeah, that's the home for that is the 501c6 nonprofit. But it now is we're being more planning and strategic and looking at what are we supposed to do? What can we do with this? But the first few years was just organic happening.
And I love the story. I've obviously heard it being involved. But, you know, one of the questions that comes to mind is, well, why do we need another group? Aren't there enough groups in cybersecurity that cover the professional side, the auditing side, the technical side? There's certifications from many of the groups. Why another group? And obviously the market or the people that are trying to solve this problem weren't getting to the information and the networking that needed to happen because IT and OT personalities, workforce is a very different kind of market or model. It sounds like there's been a demand for that that's progressed like domestically and then internationally over time pretty rapidly.
You nailed it. I think the reason we exist and have grown so rapidly is because it's a different sort of mashup of individuals. So there are IT cyber, you know, kind of traditional cybersecurity groups, a number of them. There are engineering groups, quite a number of them. Some of them are quite large. When you start talking about how do we get, you know, and their demographics are probably predominantly made up of those people. Our demographics are a mix of people from information technology backgrounds and people from engineering backgrounds and operating backgrounds, you know, plant operators, management of those same installations. And we have the full stack from people entering the workforce to engineers who are in a plant or in a refinery, all the way up to, you know, chief level people responsible for some of those things. And so it's a mix of those folks. In fact, one of our mandates now is to build bridges between those groups. There is an often dysfunction between those same people at the same company. We got to get them together and say, you each bring something to this puzzle. Pieces of the puzzle, right? You got to work together. So I think that's where one of the reasons. I think there's some other factors, but one of the reasons that we've probably grown and are resonating with people is we're bringing those different groups together and we're focused. We do not cover or have speakers and seminars and educational workshops on traditional IT cybersecurity. That's well covered. We stick to the engineered networks, the control-related networks. Now, not just oil and gas and manufacturing, but building control systems, you know, navigation systems, transportation systems. But those all have things in common: pumps, actuators, valves, you know, levers, physical, cyber to physical systems all embedded with each other. And that's a whole different ballgame. And it takes expertise from all those different camps.
We just did a project for a client that's in the food supply chain that wouldn't normally be considered obviously critical infrastructure. Food is at some level, we need to eat to live. Just begun to be asked by their end customers, grocery stores and restaurant chains and that sort of thing. What are you doing to be resilient? What happens if you're ransomwared? And in that conversation with them, they had IT, the things that ran in the front office and the salespeople used and their accountants used and other traditional knowledge workers. But then they had OT that was connected to that environment and management wasn't aware that there was a difference. Technology is technology, right?
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about some of the differences that there's, I know from being involved in the group and from working in this world, that there's a difference between IT and OT, both technically, but also that cultural difference. And that's the thing I think executives, business leaders in the manufacturing space may not understand, that Joe in the warehouse or Joe on the factory floor is different in his toolbox than Joe in the IT department. What's so different that makes those two groups kind of conflict in terms of their activities?
It's one of the heart of the matter questions that you're asking. That there's no question. It's different things, right? And so I'm not picking these in a particular order, but we are talking about, you know, sort of very different environments, work environments. So over here in the traditional IT network, not to say that everybody doesn't, you know, there's no impact, just let's reboot, but you can, let's just reboot. And they do it all the time. Like, oh, oops, let's reboot the system. You know, downtime might not be good. I know there's some IT people like, well, we can't just reboot whenever we want, but there might be a power plant that says we're going to reboot in November on November 6th for 6 hours is the only time that plant can come down. That's a very different constraint than over here. Manufacturing line. Every minute we are down, we know exactly what that is going to cost us. So we're not going to go down arbitrarily. We're not going to use a security tool that's going to actively scan the network and send out packets to older technology, another Easter egg there, older technology that doesn't want to receive that kind of communication and chokes when it gets it. And so I use a security tool and I bring the network down. You know, so there's a difference. It's different technology with different constraints, different obligations, safety. Not a word that these folks over here even have to ever even use for the most part, maybe a fire. So a Halon system or a, you know, a CO2 system to, you know, put out a fire in a server room. That's it. Here, no, safety's got a whole nother ballgame. We got all sorts of moving parts and things going and processes going on, hot molten material being poured in over here. Safety, you know, reliability and assurance, you know, of that are key. And confidentiality, the CIA model, the C is not first over here. It might be over here, but it's not over here. So I think it's different technology. It's different people, different age bracket. You're going to have the average age of the person working in information technology and the average person working in operating technology or in a control environment, like a manufacturing concern. They're fundamentally going to maybe talk differently, have different origins, different educational paths, and then these different constraints and focuses. It makes it very challenging. And there can be distrust between those groups because sometimes there's been harm done unintentionally, let's say, and most of the time, unintentionally done in the operating technology environment by well-meaning IT background or cybersecurity people who haven't yet gotten some of the knowledge they needed from this side over here about reliability and rebooting not being a good option in many cases.
Well, we've found in some of the manufacturing work that we do that there's a lot of, to borrow a fairly old cultural references, a lot of MacGyvering to make things work. And so wires that you wouldn't expect to find in an office environment between systems, Wi-Fi routers that are bought at Best Buy and put up on a shelf that's probably too hot for that system, because the end game is to get the product out the door at a fast enough pace that we're making enough money in sometimes very thin margin environments to continue to be profitable, which is there's a different set of tolerances in that kind of environment. That just the rebooting example, we have a client that signs a just-in-time agreement. Any line that they put under that agreement has to stay as it was implemented for 18 months. It cannot come down for 18 months. And I challenge any of us to work on our laptop for 18 months and not being able to reboot at least once.
Woo! Yeah, that's a scary proposition. What a great example, Doug. I mean, that's what we're talking about. You know, that's one of many iterations of this. Like, it is different. You know, and every now and then there's some speaker or pundit saying, you know, a network is a network is a network. You know, no, there are networking principles. So there are things that the operating technology people can absolutely learn from IT background, cybersecurity people. There's no question. That's why I say, hey, get together. I don't like any of the perspectives people take of that one or the other. Not really, not one of these environments. You're going to have to create more unicorns, people that really do understand both of these pieces. And that's, you know, those are the people in the industry, right? People say, well, where do they come from? Well, they might come more from an operating technology or engineering background and then learn what they need from cyber. Okay, that might, you know, I've heard that argument that that's the best direction, but there are clearly people coming from IT, you know, backgrounds, and they somewhere get introduced to operating technology along the way. However that path or journey happens, you got to take some stuff from both disciplines.
Well, when we get back to gathering people of like-minded interest in Columbus and very frankly, putting a beer in between the attendees and the speaker, that those events, when we get back to that, it's going to be the mix of the folks that you just described. We had people that had been, they wore steel-toed boots in the factory floor, would feel very awkward in the business front office and No, I don't think anybody wears ties anymore, but a little bit better dressed, and you know, hot conditions. I put them in the room with people that had been, following frameworks and dealing with privacy and confidentiality oriented regulations. I think there's lessons to be learned just from what I've learned, kind of running down at the top of the list. The regulations are coming. The OT guys are going to have to deal with those. There's alphabet soup that's finding its way into that, either from the government or from regulatory bodies or contracts. I think the OT people, at least prior to this Colonial Gas Pipeline event and the JBS meatpacking event, were somewhat skeptical that anybody was really going to break into their tools. That's a lesson to be learned from the IT side. And then from the OT to the IT folks, it's this urgency and resiliency that has to occur in an environment that can never come down. Yeah. And so let's talk about Colonial. I think that put this on the map more than anything else. It didn't interrupt just the business. It interrupted life in a large part of the country. And, you know, it really speaks to what you alluded to earlier, which is one of the differences between IT and OT is in OT, we're touching the physical world. So it's safety, but it's any other kind of chaos that you can create physically. And we saw that with Colonial.
I think it was another, you know, kind of canary in the coal mine. It, you know, I've always loved that term and look for use. You look to places to use it, but you know, and it's not the only one, but it impacted a wider audience in visceral kind of real ways. They could judge, I can't get gas. So it even there are people not in our industry that saw it and heard it. In fact, we did a very last minute webcast, a new CSA product. We call it Debrief. We conceived it on Friday, marketed on Monday, held it on Wednesday, and got, you know, over 748 registrations for it, and over 500 people came. That right there. Now, our numbers for our events are actually quite high typically, but that was unusual. Well, I think it's because it tapped into a greater consciousness of what just happened. You know, what was that about? I want to go to this thing and learn a little bit more about it. And we had a lot of C-level, you know, or senior level participation in that. And that I took as a good sign, right? I don't wish these events to happen, but they do wake people up. You know, in that particular case was interesting. It wasn't, as my panel, you know, quickly revealed, it wasn't an attack on an operating technology system. It was an attack on an operating technology company. And then a series of decisions got made. And due to abundance of caution, they ended up, you know, affecting the operating technology network. But it wasn't a big leap that someone could have, you know, there are ways to affect, you know, potentially the network directly, the operating technology network. In this case, it was affect the minds of the people and the people operating all this and cause enough chaos, confusion, not sure what's happening, whatever, to cause them to affect their network in ways that, you know, I don't know what the total price tag will be, but way more than the ransom that they paid and I think recovered or whatever. That number, 5 million, is nothing compared to the overall economics of the incident. And that's what wakes people up, right? That's what management and board levels and C-level people go, oh, we could have a threat actor do something to us that could really be a fundamental financial impact to us that's not good. And like the answer, of course, is yes.
And then JBS followed that, the meatpacking plant, what, a week or 2 weeks later?
Yeah.
And then what we're hearing from cyber liability insurance carriers and brokers that because of two large payouts, that there's been a market recreated for the ransomware folks. And off to the races we go now, trying to defend an ever increasing volume of attacks that have the potential now of at least spooking that industry, any industry that has operational technology or operational deliverables is a part of their business. And we're hearing in a lot of ways, premiums are rising and the expectations on the part of the carriers to properly protect. But in some ways, there's not the definition of properly protect. There's not the regulations and the frameworks as readily available for the operational technology side. So we've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Well, I think in our careers, we'll never see the end of this. I mean, maybe there is no end. We won't see the end of it. I think what is a board member, business owner, C-level person, executive level manager, whatever you want to call it, somebody that's got to make some decisions. What do they need to do today? Do they need to try to figure out how to have everything we do be secure? Sounds daunting, and maybe they do nothing, or they're overwhelmed by it, or we don't have the budget for that. Like, no, just start mitigating some risk. Bring, if you don't know, you know, which many of them don't, but you got to bring somebody in who then says, okay, you can't do all this. Do these three things. Because if you do these three things, you take your risk from 10% and you cut it by 50%, let's say. Don't worry about, oh my God, to get to highly secure seems daunting. Well, to get to highly secure, it's probably going to be a bit daunting. But to get to better than where you are now in 80% of the cases is not daunting. there's stuff that you're not doing that's very low-hanging fruit. Do that. So I think that's everybody's mandate. And I think there will be liability for those that can't prove that they're at least doing that. Say, are you doing, you know, what are you doing any of the best practices? You know, and they need to ask themselves that and say, are we doing a suite of best practices, not buying all the latest technology, not hiring all kinds of people? Are we doing at least these core risk mitigating steps? And I think there'll be liability for people who aren't doing that.
Well, I think you're seeing some of it creep in. It was, I believe, 2 years ago, the SEC put guidance out, which said that if there's a most breach events, we're talking a little bit of inside ball now, but most breach events are confidentiality events, and their report had the reportable based on HIPAA, payment card, FTC, state data breach notification requirements. But if my production line three goes down because of a ransomware event or some other kind of a denial of service attack or something else, it's just technical problems. And nobody really thinks anything of it. And SEC two or three years ago, I tend to blank out last year, as most of us want to, but essentially said, if there's a material impact in a security event, it has to be reportable. So now we're at the public company level.
Yeah.
And it'll trickle down. It's typically how things work, from company level to their suppliers, and then nonprofit boards, and et cetera, et cetera. That is certainly coming. You can look at what's happened on the IT side, and it's not hard to see the same pattern.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's one where people, I hope they don't get, you know, paralyzed with anxiety about it. They just say, if I can be shown to be taking prudent steps, that's going to be a big deal. If I can, equally so, if I can be shown to be really not paying attention, that could hurt me, or hurt our enterprise, or hurt my job. And I think we'll see more executive level, including the CEOs, removed over negligence. And it's not that you've had an incident, because that's going to be hard to stop in many cases. It's depending on who the threat actor is, it might be impossible to stop having any kind of incident. It's about, what did we do? Did we take some prudent steps? Not never having an incident.
We are very big on, to use your terms, helping executives understand what choices they might have in taking prudent steps. Yeah. We're enormous advocates for the National Institute of Science and Technology's critical security or cybersecurity framework, which it primarily was aimed at critical security. Yep. But even we do a lot of restaurant work. Even the National Restaurant Association has adopted that as the framework. And it's easy. I can talk to executives about, do you identify what's important, your assets? Do you protect them? Do you detect them? Can you respond to an event? And can you recover from it? And I can, at a business level, explain that and not need to get into the details, the engineering details of the PLC that drives the boom that carries the molten steel that goes into the forms. I just need to, as an executive, know that, yeah, that's part of our asset base. And we have looked at that, and it's to a reasonable level, been protected. And I think that abstract helps that awareness, because it is, some of this stuff is very, sounds like Star Trek episodes, and people that aren't technical tune out, and then that works their way into a liability situation where they don't understand. So they tune out, and then that tuning out causes a problem for them.
Yeah. Although people in the industry, those of us that are working on this problem, also do better at our communication, right? I mean, maybe some of that tune out could be avoided by how we communicate and not overloading people.
The jargon is terrible. It sounds like we've either pulled all of it from a video game or some, you know, war novel, and it all sounds very cool. And unfortunately, sometimes jargon creates a closed society. And I think we've certainly done that in cybersecurity.
Yeah, I think you're right.
We have this international organization. We're helping connect people, talk about the problem of protecting operational technology, mostly local chapters, meeting over a beer or breaking bread together in formal physical chapter meetings. And then COVID hits. And like any good entrepreneur, you adjusted, adopted. And tell me a little bit more about what's going on. You've alluded to it. You guys are creating great content. How have you adjusted to the world that is today, which is not a lot of enthusiastically social people getting together even yet still, even though we're opening back up?
Yeah, well, I mean, you nailed it. It became a real challenge. And we did have quite a few operating, you know, physical chapters, which we assume, you know, those will come back, because like you said, breaking bread together, having a drink together, it's hard to replace that. That's an essential piece that we see as part of our original founding DNA. And it'll come back in the opportunity where that sort of space where that went away, We said, well, what can we do? Well, we've done some, you know, some global webcasts. Maybe we should do a few more of those because we've got great speakers all over the world and we've got people all over the world that are hungry for the content. You know, 21,000 and counting, and mid 21,000s in signups. And we know the problem is ubiquitous. We know it's global. You know, there's very little, you know, statistic from our research and our surveying. It's not like, oh, the people here care about this. And the people over there have this figured out. We all around the world are that are anybody who's looking at this problem space is challenged with a lot of the same challenges. And so the people who can share their wisdom, and that's this seems to be one of our opportunities, is take the wisdom of the few, the unicorns, and share them with the many. You know, that'd be one of our pillars, right? That we should deliver on that. And so we started doing more of these webcasts. And now we're at an op tempo of nearly every week. This week we had two for the first time because we did one in feature sort of time zone appropriate for Europe. And then we did a regular one on Wednesdays at 1 o'clock, typically. Wednesdays at 1 o'clock Eastern is our, you know, our normal format. And we're just getting record numbers to those. And so I think it's the content. You know, we take a continued look at how we run those sessions and what they're about and what some of the pieces and parts of it. And don't take anything for granted of not wasting people's time. And I think a lot of those bets that we made and tuning some things, you know, testing some things have really paid off. And so we're getting, you know, very unusual numbers pretty much routinely now and that often. And there's so many things, so many topics. We may do more than one a week as time goes by and have technical tracks, you know, because we don't have all the same appeal. If you think about our membership, it's got C-level people all the way down to entry-level people. And so we may start to break out and say, this one is geared towards, it's going to get really technical on this. And this one is about policy, you know, just making sure that we're reaching the right part of our demographic with the stuff they need most.
Both of those, highly technical and policy, the audiences would be different. And it would be like freshman year at Miami. I think I'm in the wrong class. You were one that you didn't have an interest in. So we will, on the webpage that promotes this cast, link to the organization. As you said, there's regular content coming out on a regular schedule, but also as events unfold, sometimes there'll be chatter amongst the LinkedIn group that, you know, we need to do something. And like you shared, the colonial response was to educate, because most journalists didn't go to school to understand cybersecurity. So that was an educational piece as much to let people know what was really going on, rather than what was appearing in the news. So we'll encourage people there. Any manufacturing people here in Columbus that are listening to this, once we get back to, is it a watch party of the Wednesday events during lunchtime? Or is it back to what most of the people in both the IT and OT world, there is commonality in that they enjoyed seeing slides and great conversation over a nice cold beer. And we could use that to build the network. We assume we could hopefully get back to those things.
Yeah.
Feel free to reach out. So thanks for that. And then I want to close with the last line before I got to Miamian and friend was adventurer. So let's talk adventures. What's been the last big adventure in the Harp family household, or maybe in the Derek Harp individual adventure list, as you were able to step away from family life and just go have fun?
Well, it's actually both of those. We run a summer business on the island of Bonaire. It's about 50 miles north of Venezuela. COVID sort of disrupted it. So last year we did not get to go at all, but this year we got to go back. And so we were there for 5 weeks. We do a variety of things there, but it's around adventure, scuba diving being very central to it. I'm a scuba instructor with Patty. And so I teach scuba, I guide scuba for people who are already certified, and I teach everything from 10-year-olds to, you know, to 80-year-olds and everything in between. And so that is just a very different thing than what I normally do. So it's very cathartic, therapeutic. It is a bit work. It's not an extended vacation, but it certainly has an escape vacation part of it.
Well, you're off the keyboard, so it's something different.
Very different. Very different.
And I noticed that when I was looking at it. It's funny when you know somebody and then you start to research them and you still find new things out. And his LinkedIn, if you go visit his LinkedIn anytime soon, is going to have this nice scuba picture in the background. And I thought, wait, I thought he was a backpacker.
That's my real love affair. I did learn or get introduced to scuba diving through scouts, which you and I have in common.
Yes.
When I was a young scout, I went to the High Adventure Base in Florida and I got
Sea Base
when I was 15. Yeah, Sea Base. And I got certified when I was 15 or 14. And so all the years have gone by and I became an instructor. And really, there was a gap. And I'm back in touch with this in the last 6 years. And it's just been a super meaningful dimension. And my family dives. My youngest can't do it yet, but has certainly done a lot in the pool. But everybody else does, and we do it together. And I have other family members and certainly close friends I've introduced to it, or that we do it together. That family, you know, atmosphere. And so on Bonaire, there's other adventures there. We're starting to facilitate business groups there. that's our sort of unfolding dream, is to bring people down there and say, you can do some business. We can, you know, we can be part of that or not part of that, depending on what your goal is. And then put some adventure that we can package for you and facilitate for you. And so we've had a few experiments there. And I'm planning a cybersecurity leaders conference for there for next year. I'm really excited about that. And so that'll be sort of senior security decision makers. And there'll be some very intimate forum experience. Everybody will get to know each other. And so the network will absolutely multiply. But there'll be some direct knowledge as well gained.
Oh, I'll be waiting for the save the date on that Bonaire trip. Anyway, that sounds tremendous. I have to confess, there's a group of guys I backpack with that our initial time together was out at Philmont with our boys. It turned out being an odd dad and son, five of us, father and son pairing. And one of the guys has been to Seabase since twice. And we make fun of him all the time because it was heavy boots at Philmont and it was flip-flops at Seabase. The truth and the confession is it's jealousy.
Yeah. So, Yeah.
Oh, that sounds really cool. Time for the final countdown. We have five quick questions we're going to ask. And just off the top of your head, we want to know a little bit more about you and what comes to mind. What did you dream of becoming when you were in middle school?
A spy.
A spy. That's cool.
Yeah.
A cyber spy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was just thinking, you know, the traditional sort of like deep cover operative type work. I didn't end up going into that, but it was really fascinating to me. Still is.
Who inspires you?
You know, Richard Branson. I followed him for years, and he's sort of his brand of entrepreneurship and sort of his some of his things, programs and companies have always fascinated me.
What is your favorite life hack?
You know, a diet. I've lost about 50 pounds since January, and something I struggled with for most of my adult life, you know, slightly getting larger every year since I left the military. This year, figuring out with my wife, you know, sort of what I eat and how that affects me and just the impact on my life has been, you know, already sort of energy and everything has been so much better.
What has been your most valuable failure?
You know, that's been startups that didn't make it. You know, I've had a 24-year run of creating companies and entities and they haven't always worked. You know, more often than not, startups don't. And so I've learned a ton from those. And sometimes those have been painful learning lessons, but they've, you know, I feel like I've got a couple of PhDs in entrepreneurship experiences.
At the School of Hard Knocks. That gotcha.
Yeah.
So last question, you work hard. How do you play to balance life? And you may have already answered that, but if there's more to the story, how do you balance life?
I work hard. I always have, but I've recommitted to, you know, my wife and my children, but I created a nexus there. It's not like just generically like, well, scuba is really a big deal for me. So I'm doing that with them. So that's good for me too. You know, I didn't, you know, we're doing something together that I'm passionate about, but also is really great time with them. And so I had some of the best moments with my oldest son this summer, scuba diving, just he and I, you know, in the place that we go every summer and sort of, you know, run sort of our summer operation with and introduce other people to it. But the quality moments with my own family were huge. And so that's great. And scouting's, you know, a way we also tap into adventure and doing stuff together. So it's really a commitment to doing things, you know, with them and with some of the friends that are around those things too. And even so, sometimes people are like, how can you afford to go on that trip or do that? I'm like, how can I afford not to? That's an investment in myself, my family, and my friends. And life is too short. So I can't afford not to do those things, even though, yes, it's time away from a lot of work.
So if we had a sixth question, which was what was the best investment, it would be the way you play life and enjoy family. That's a great answer. Derek, thanks for joining us. We will sure see each other and cross paths continuously here into the future. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Doug. It's real pleasure.
Time's up. Thanks for listening to this episode of Empower Hour. Join us next time by subscribing to Empower Hour on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your preferred listening platform. Want more GBQ? We don't blame you. Visit us online at gbq.com for the business news and advice that matters most. Who is empowering your growth?